All right, just a fresh reminder for those of you who may be new to us here on Wednesday nights at Greenville Springs. We call it Ask Jeff. That's kind of the title we've given it because that's the Facebook post, etc. But really what tonight is this. This is a Bible study that you have the privilege of directing. Everything we discuss tonight is either from a question that you've placed in this box or one that typically happens when you raise your hand after we address a question in the box. So we're going to go ahead and get to it for the sake of time. Somebody accused me that I don't mix it up very well. I don't know what else to do to make you happy. Go up and down. This is going to look great on TV. And I look like I'm, this is an infomercial for a new like church-based exercise program. We'll get some calls on that one probably. All right, here we go. Okay, we kind of addressed this a couple weeks ago. But I'm convinced that if a question comes out a second time, maybe we need to revisit it. That makes sense. It says, since people die at different ages, when we get to heaven, will we be the age of Jesus when he died on earth? It's a great question. And the best way to answer it is to go to the book of 1 John, chapter 3. The question was asked a couple of weeks ago, very similar to this. It was about what would be the potential or actual age of a baby that died and went to heaven, what they remain the same age or such. And I guess one of the issues we've got to deal with as we go to 1 John 3 is this, is that when an individual dies and goes to heaven, is the concept of the age, the appearance, the what they may seem like when they're there. And I think we would all agree on both sides of the extreme spectrums. You take, like King David mentioned in 2 Samuel, you take a baby that is 7 days of age that passes. I don't think there's a one of us here who has in their mind the thought that that infant would be in that status for all of eternity. On the same idea, you take an individual who is 101 years of age, whose body has completely become a decrepit from a physical perspective. I don't think any of us say, oh yeah, for all of eternity, just like they were in the nursing home when they passed. I don't think we disagree on the extremes. The question is, when and where do we come to the middle ground and what does that look like? Well, in 1 John chapter 3, we get a pretty good idea or picture of what we may have the appearance of. Because in 1 John chapter 3, verse 2, it says, beloved, now are we the sons of God? It doth not yet appear what we shall be. But, there's that word again. We know that when he shall appear, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. And what I believe 1 John 3 is saying is that for all of eternity, when we receive our incorruptible bodies, I think the Bible is very conclusive that everybody is 6'6" in heaven for all of eternity. No, I'm kidding about that. But what I do believe is this. That as Jesus Christ, he lived, he died, he rose again. Please understand that when he raised from the grave, nobody said, wow, you're taller now. Nobody said, man, you're shorter now. His appearance did not vary greatly from just a few days earlier. When the apostle John sees him in Revelation chapter 1, in Revelation chapter 1, Jesus has a different appearance, not because he has aged, but because the Jesus who will return has a different function than the Jesus that was raised from the grave. In fact, when Jesus Christ, when he returns in Revelation chapter 19, it says he's riding upon a horse. It talks about the fact that his clothing is brought above his knee. There's writings on his thigh. It mentions his mouth. It mentions his feet. In other words, the appearance we have or that he has does not vary greatly from the one in which we witness in the Gospels. Here in 1 John 3, it says, you know what? We don't know what we're going to be one day in all of eternity, but when he appears, we shall be as he is. And so I know it's not a real specific answer because the question was about the age. Are we going to be 33 and a half years old? You know, I don't know, but would any of us complain? Now, if I were with the student ministry tonight, they might. Because if you don't know, and this has been proven with, you know, all these kind of smart people, that somebody thinks that old is 15 years older than they are. Ask a 15-year-old, somebody who's old, and they'll tell you somebody who's 30 to 35. Okay? But to most of us in this room who are over the age of 33 and a half, would we get upset if we found out we were going to be 33 and a half for all of eternity? I'm going to tell you what, some of us would celebrate. I think that if that is the case, that is proof that eternity is eating all you want without gaining the weight. Because at that age, I could eat all I wanted and not gain the weight. And I actually had the energy to do the things I wanted to do. But I am going to receive a glorified body that will not be susceptible to those laws that we're limited to here on earth. Now, can we conclusively say that eternity is comprised of individuals that are 33 and a half years of age? No. But what we can conclusively say is that the eternal body of Jesus Christ, our appearance will be similar to His and eternal and immortal as His. Hopefully that does answer that question. I don't think we can give an exact time or age frame to it because it doesn't mention that about Jesus. Any? Yes, sir. Oh, wow. Two of y'all. Go for it. The transfiguration of Moses and Elijah. Yes, sir. That's a great question. Go to Matthew chapter 17. The question is, when Peter, James, and John, when Jesus takes them up on what we call the Mount of Transfiguration, Matthew chapter 17, it says that Jesus goes up and there are two men with him who appear. And I'm going to go ahead and read it. Beginning in verse 1 of Matthew 17, after 6 days, Jesus taketh Peter, James, and John, his brother, bringeth them up to a high mountain apart, was transfigured before them, his face did shine as the sun, his raiment as white as the light, and behold, there appeared unto them Moses and Elijah talking with him. Then answered Peter and said unto Jesus, Lord, is it good for us to be here? If thou wilt, let us make here 3 tabernacles, one for thee, one for Moses, one for Elijah. Now, let me go back to the specific question that you asked, sir. Peter did not ask Jesus, who are those guys? He did not ask that, did he? He said, let's build 3 tabernacles, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. Now, they had never witnessed what they would have actually looked like because Elijah's being taken up in the famous chariot of fire and Moses' death was many years before. They did not have digital photography like you and I have today. And I doubt they had pictures on the wall that showed them what these guys looked like. I think this passage does not answer so much the question, what age will we be? But the fact that those in eternity will have instant recognition of all. Because that's one of the great questions. How will we know everybody? Is it going to take 10,000 years to learn everybody's name? Well, in this passage, they knew exactly who they were. They didn't say, wow, is that Habakkuk? Is that Jonah? They knew it was Moses and Elijah. Now, I doubt they had the hello, I'm Moses tag on. I doubt it. And so I think what that does is it addresses their immediate identification versus an age. Does that help with those two? Kind of, sort of. How can we get it to most assuredly? Okay, so how we will appear to others. Okay, so are you asking the question, may you appear differently to me than you appear to somebody else? Let me tell you, I like that idea, but I don't like that idea. And here's why. Because I think Jesus is going to appear the same to everybody. And if we're going to be as He is, so why? And this is the example I give. My grandfather passed away. He was in his mid-60s, forgive me for not knowing the exact date, but I was a child when it happened. I remember my grandfather as a very stout, strong, full silver-headed man. It's not the same picture that his mother or grandmother remembers him. You know, completely different. That being said, 1 John 3, we don't know yet what we shall be like, but we will be as He is. And so Jesus appears the same to all. And so I think we will, too. I don't know what that's going to be. I'm voting for 6'6", right here. I'm just letting you know. So I don't think it's going to happen. But He does say, ask and you shall receive, right? Seek and you shall find. And I've knocking every day of my life. But it's not being opened up, brother. So, once again, one day we're going to know the answer to this question. Notice what it says. We don't yet know. He made that very clear. Everybody might be fine. That's right. See, you may be right. Maybe in heaven you're all my size. There you go, brother. Now we're talking. Yes, ma'am. And I'll get back to you, ma'am. Okay, the question asked was, because I mentioned my grandfather. Well, I know that was my grandfather. There is nothing in the Bible that says I will and nothing in the Bible that says I won't. How's that for a nice answer? We're known as, well, it says we'll be as he is. It never says we're known as we're known. No, it says we shall be known as he is. So I don't know, by the way, and I know I've mentioned this to y'all before, do not call me Brother or Pastor Jeff in heaven. That's not my name. It says in Revelation 2, I have a new name. I have a new name, a new height. Well, that's not in there, but I want it to be. But the point is, I do have a new name. It says I have a new name that only the Lord knows. And so here's how I see that. I think one of the struggles that we have as humanity is that we are finite. We know beginnings and we know endings. We know when we go to a cemetery and we look at a tombstone, there's the date of beginning, there's the date of ending, correct? We see that. We're used to beginnings and endings. Football season begins and football season ends. We know that. Even if you win the championship, it does end. And so our brains are finite. We cannot grasp the infinite. God is infinite. He can get that. And so I think we struggle with, if I don't look like people are used to me looking like, and I'm not called but what people are used to me calling, how are people going to know me? But yet Moses and Elijah showed up to his question, and Peter and John and James instantly knew who these guys were without an issue, without a question. It was immediate. And so I just go with the fact that when we are there, we will be completely known by everybody in the way that God wants us completely known. I rest assured in that. Now, I know what we say. We say, oh, but there's people that are here on earth that are just so special to me. There's also people on earth that are not so special to you. Think about that for a moment. In other words, we always say, oh, but my spouse, oh, but my kids. But what about the neighbor you never got along with? See, we never think about it on the other side. Yes, sir. Oh, yes. I'm glad you brought that up, sir, because what he stated was we will not know who is not there. Because in Revelation chapter 21, when it says the new heaven, the new earth, the new Jerusalem, it says that he creates those all new. And it says all former things are passed away. Now, y'all know what the word all means, right? All. And it says there's no more tears, there's no more heartache, there's no more pain. And so, even though I don't want to dismiss the value of relationships here on earth, you get the idea, not that God removes what was valuable here, but gives us something even more valuable there. I don't know if that communicates that idea. And so I think what we think is an incredible relationship here, God's got something infinitely greater. We think what we experience with somebody at whatever relationship's fabulous here, he's got better. Yes, ma'am, way in the back. Sorry. There you go. Right. Here's what I can guarantee. Here's what I'll guarantee you. I'll guarantee you, because it mentioned 1 John 3, which was the original question. As a child of God, when I show up to the streets of gold, I promise you, the first thing out of my mouth is going to be, this is good. I don't think any of us are going to look around going, oh, this wasn't what I was hoping. I think we're going to be, yes, sir. And I am coming to your question, ma'am, I promise. And that's a scary thought, the level of our minds trying to figure it out. I hope so. He's saying that he'll have a higher capacity of understanding. Hey, I'm going to tell you what. Peter and James and John, they were not the brightest bulbs in the chandelier. Would y'all give them credit for that? I mean, I respect them as being apostles, but you do remember Jesus feeds 5,000, gives them all a basket of food. They go across the Sea of Galilee, and it says they forgot that he fed the 5,000. That's not brilliance, okay? But in Matthew 17, they're not sitting there going, they immediately knew. Like you said, there is just, the finite becomes infinite, the mortal becomes immortal. The limited becomes eternal. And I know it comforts us. It's such comfort to know that what we have here will be like we have here, maybe even greater. But I think his greater is even so far greater than what we even think our greater might be. If that makes sense. So, ma'am, you had a question. Okay. Okay, her question was, what about children in heaven? If everybody's growing up, we're not going to have any children in heaven, which makes it heaven. I so apologize. You can tell I have three little boys in my house when I say that. I am teasing. I promise I am teasing. But to your point, I could say the same thing about we talked about the little babies and we talked about the older. Now, I'm not saying this just because many of you fit into this category. I really enjoy senior adults. I think y'all are a lot of fun. I just want y'all to know, okay? You are, because you just say what you want to say and get away with it. It's awesome. But to my same point, you also get the idea there won't be, quote, senior adults either. And that's enjoyable. And so I think, once again, it goes back to what we find so enjoyable, what we find so comforting, what we find so life-giving will be, I think, minuscule compared. Now, let's go back to Matthew 17, because I want you to think about what Peter, James, and John offer to build them. Let us build you tabernacles. You know what a tabernacle means? It's a tent. It's a tent. Now, do you know what Jesus promised in John 14? A mansion. It's almost as if they said, man, the greatest thing we can come up with. And Jesus is like, a tent? I mean, come on, guys. Let's do mansion here. It's streets of pure gold and massive. It's almost as if, here's Peter, here's Moses, here's Elijah, here's Jesus. Man, let's go camping! Because in their world, that would have been the greatest thing. A tabernacle like Moses had. But Jesus said, no, I've got mansions prepared for you. It's almost as if their greatest understanding was limited compared to his understanding. Now, I'm just going to say this one last time. There are relationships on earth that I adore. There are perspectives that I appreciate. But I think even my greatest perspective or greatest relationship will pale in comparison to what God has planned. It makes sense. What I love, because I'm a people person, I love the fact that when I get there, according to Matthew 17, I know who everybody is. And we're going to have one long eternal fellowship. It's going to be a good time. We're going to have a lot of fun. So, anything else on that subject? It's a fun one. It's not been revealed. Yeah, she made a great statement. It's not necessarily what we're going to look like. It's getting there. Absolutely. And you're absolutely right about that. We get there through Jesus Christ. What he wants us to look like is up to him. If he wants me to be 6'8", I'm good with that. Not a problem. I'm probably going to be the eternal small person in all of heaven. Y'all know that, right? Oh, there he is. Instead of being Brother Jeff, my name in heaven is going to be, oh, little one, that's you, yay. I don't know what my name is going to be, but I promise I'm going to have a lot of fun. That's all I can say. Yes, sir. Oh, no. It's all good. Don't worry. All right. Anything else on this subject? For those of you who are watching on TV, I'm sorry. I just make fun of my great height. Okay, here we go. For you, sir. I'm going to shake it up real good. Is that good enough? Hey, watch this. You ready? Yeah. Mike, we making good TV there, brother? Oh, this is okay. Now, when I read this question, you may not understand the reference point, but I know what this person is speaking of. Please explain why you said you had a mentor that was a member of three churches and not saved. Now, this question's obviously been in the box for a very long time. Many months ago, I mentioned in a Sunday morning sermon here that I had a mentor of mine. Actually, his name is Dr. Roy Fish. He has recently gone on to be with the Lord. That this man who I admired so greatly was a member of three different churches before he was saved. And I want to apologize if I miscommunicated to make it sound like that this mentor of mine was a lost man. What I was trying to communicate was that, and I'll go ahead and share with you his story in brief, that his name, as I mentioned, his name is Roy Fish, is as a young person, as a teenager, he had been at a revival meeting, and he'd gotten very convicted of his sin, and during the invitation, he walked the aisle. They shook his hand, had him fill his name out on a card, presented him to everybody, and he no more was saved when he got up than when he left. In other words, he was convicted of his sin. He was never converted from his sin. They shook his hand. He filled out a card. He goes to college. He went to college on a swimming scholarship. Goes to college. He's an athlete. He's working with these organizations that are obviously Christian, working with athletes. Another situation, he gets convicted of his sin. I need to be saved. I need to be saved. Tells somebody he wants to be saved. They said congratulations, shook his hand, made him fill out a card. Once again, he's a member of church number two. It happened a third time. The reason I shared that story was this, that one of the most important things we can do as believers when someone is convicted of their sin is properly counsel and guide them about what to do with the conviction the Holy Spirit is bringing on their heart. He got saved when he was in his early 20s. I never met him until he was in his late 60s. So he had been saved for four decades before I ever met him. And whomever wrote the question, I apologize if I miscommunicated. What I wanted to share with you is there are times, and I think this happens in probably every church, we have people who are there, they are present, they've signed a card, their name may be on the membership roll, but they don't have a saving relationship with Jesus Christ. The reason I shared that story was because what I wanted to point out was the error of those who spoke with him. They never asked him, why are you coming down? They never said, what's going on in your life? They just said, hey, congratulations, fill out the card, you're now a member of the church. That's a bad process to get caught up in. That is why here at Greenville Springs, you'll notice that when people come forward, we actually take them out of the room. We have a room set aside to talk with them, pray with them, and ask them questions. Because I don't want to ever happen here what happened to Roy Fish there, if that helps. We want people to have time to process things, to ask the right questions. Where are they actually spiritually? What's going on in their life? If it takes 5 minutes, great. If it takes 25 minutes, doesn't matter. The problem with the illustration I gave was he literally walked down the aisle, they shook his hand, they presented him. They didn't even ask him why he was there. They just assumed. So hopefully that addresses that. And again, whoever wrote the question, I apologize if I miscommunicated the information. But that's what I wanted to share. Dear, dear mentor of mine. Anything about that? Okay, moving onward. Here we go. We are going at breakneck speed tonight. This is scary. Here we go. Is that enough for you, sir? Okay, just checking. I'm shaking it right tonight. That sounds like a country song. You're shaking it right tonight. In Luke 21:32, oh, well, so much for breakneck speed. Go to Luke 21. In Luke 21:32, Jesus says, I assure you, this generation will not pass away until all things take place. Who is this generation? All right, here we go. Luke 21:32. There's also a parallel verse in Matthew 24:14. We'll go ahead and do the Luke passage. All right. Now, please understand, let me kind of go from a big picture here and then we'll zero in. Luke chapter 21, Matthew chapter 24, and Mark chapter 13. Those chapters in the Gospels are all critical because it's Jesus Christ almost just literally hours, few days before his crucifixion. He is communicating his teachings on the last days, the last times, what we know as the second coming. Okay, He is there. He is communicating. He is up on the mountain. He has taken the 12 up there. In fact, Matthew says that he takes the 12 up there and even gives an allusion that Peter, James, and John even get a little special treatment when they're up there. So Luke chapter 21, let's go to the first part of the chapter because I want you to see, you know, one of the things I think we struggle with Bible study is this. You cannot understand the answer if you don't know what the question is. I mean, think about Jeopardy for a moment. Y'all know the game show Jeopardy? All right. On the game show Jeopardy, they'll have a category. Under that category, they then provide an answer to which you have to provide a question. Well, if the answer is green, what could be the question? What? What color's the grass? Or how about what's the main name of Tracy Myers? It's a completely different question, isn't it? And it all is based on the subject matter. So you cannot separate the question from the answer. Luke 21, Matthew 24, and Mark 13 are all a teaching of Jesus based on the questions his disciples ask. So go back to the very first part of chapter 21. What we know is the Olivet Discourse. I'm going to go ahead and begin in verse 5. And as some spoke of the temple, how it was adorned with goodly stones and gifts, he said, "As for these things which you behold, the days will come in which there shall not be left one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down." Verse 7 is the key to this chapter. They asked him, saying, "Master, but when shall these things be, and what sign will there be when these things shall come to pass?" They asked two questions, when and what. When's it going to happen, and what is the sign of it happening? Now, as you go through Luke 21 or Matthew 24, obviously Jesus speaks about the things about persecution and nation against nation and people rising up, very famous passages of Scripture. The verse that's alluded to here in Luke, verse 32 of chapter 21, is actually in the middle of a parable. Okay? In the midst of the teachings, Jesus steps back in verse 29 and it says, "He spoke a parable to them." Now, what's important about the parable is this. It's like when a pastor, like myself, is preaching through the Word of God and then tells a story that relates to what he's preaching. We're taking a step back, and I like to call it the color commentary. Now, I don't know about y'all. I'm a big sports fan, and I know one has passed physically and the other has not but is retired. I don't know if we'll ever see a team of individuals that call football games as well as Pat Summerall and John Madden. John Madden never gave us the details of anything. All he did was draw on the screen and point out the fun stuff about the game. Pat Summerall's job was to tell us who made the play, how it happened, and how many yards they got. John Madden's goal was, if the game wasn't any fun, to make it fun for us. The reason I use that illustration is parables often are used as the color commentary to the teaching. So Jesus is telling all this stuff about the end times, the temple, the abomination of desolation, the Antichrist, all this stuff. Can you imagine? I want you to put yourself in their position. It's Passover week. It's the greatest celebration in the Jewish year. They're seeing cousins and family and celebrating. And these guys, they're with the celebrity. I mean, they're with the man. You realize that at the beginning of this week, Jesus has ridden in on a donkey. Tens of thousands of people have said, "He's the man." He then goes and overturns the tables, and all the people who are opposed to them are all counseling how to kill him. So everybody who loves him is adoring him. Everybody who hates him is trying to have him killed, and they're getting to hang out with him. And all of a sudden, he takes them up on the mountain and says, "Guess what, guys? It's going to get awful. They're going to rise up against you. They're going to persecute you. The temple is going to be torn down. What we know is the beast of the Antichrist is going to set up the abomination of desolation. Hey, when that stuff happens, you need to take off and run." Can you imagine? You'd be in shell shock is what you'd be. And in the midst of all that teaching, beginning in verse 29 in Luke, he says, "Now let me speak," or he speaks to them a parable. "Okay, guys, I've given you the meat. Let's step back and give a little color commentary. Behold the fig tree and all the trees. When they now shoot forth, you see and know of your own selves that summer is now nigh at hand. So likewise ye, when you see these things come to pass. Know ye that the kingdom of God is not hand. Verily I say unto you, this generation shall not pass away till all be fulfilled. Heaven and earth will pass away, my word shall not pass away. The question is, who is this generation? The generation is not the generation of the apostles. You say, well, do you know that just because it's been 2,000 years since? No. Because he defines the generation with two items. The parable is the fig tree. In the Old Testament, the fig tree is always synonymous with Israel. Read Zechariah. It's all about the fig tree and the branches and such. So here he says, learn the parable of the fig tree. And then he throws in, and as other trees, that when you begin to see it shoot forth, know the fruit is coming. Just like you and I know right now, we go out to our backyards or front yards or whatever acreage you've got. We got a bunch of trees out there. They appear just as dead can be, right? There's no fruit. There's no green. They're just brown sticks everywhere with moss hanging off of them. Okay. That's where they are. The other day, my kids came up to me. Dad, how long till spring? This is my first time to live in Louisiana. I don't have a clue. I really don't. You know what I said? I said sometime between now and the 4th of July. I don't know. It'll be here. So, that being said, when I go out in the backyard and I begin to see the budding of the trees and my kids ask me the same question, I can say it's right around the corner. Because as those trees begin to bud, it's telling me that the fruit is soon there. And when the trees start bearing the fruit, we know it's that season, right? What he is saying here is, as a tree begins to bear its leaves, if it begins to bear its leaves, then what was happening before? It had no leaves. You do know that for about 1900 years, Israel had no leaves. It was a barren tree. But what happened about 50 to 60 years ago? It started budding. Aha. Jesus says, when you see the fig tree start to bud, pay attention. Now, he was not saying here that at the point that the tree starts to bud, that's the last generation. What did he say the last generation was? Verse 31, when you see these things come to pass. When what is happening in chapter 21 of Luke, what is happening in chapter 24 of Matthew and 13 of Mark, when those things actually start happening before your eyes, he literally says, this is it. This is the last generation. And so to answer that question, who is the last generation? I believe the last generation is that generation which actually in their eyes will see these things coming to pass. Does that mean that we're getting close to the time frame, folks? The tree has budded. It's there. The tree is budded. The fruit is ready. We don't know. We just don't know. Now, let me go back a step. Every generation has somehow thought they were the last one. Okay? I mean, there was turmoil about 1,000 years ago when we went from like 999 to 1,000 AD. People were in panic mode. I mean, the Lord is coming back. But what is experienced here in chapter 21 was not happening there at that time. Are we beginning to see some of the stuff happen here? Absolutely. In fact, we'll just go back in chapter 21 here. Let's go back to verse 8. Take heed that you be not deceived, for many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ. Well, we've seen that happen over the years, right? There's been people all throughout time who said, oh, I'm the Messiah. I'm the Messiah. But when you shall hear, verse 9, when you shall hear of wars and commotions, be not terrified, for these things must come to pass. The end is not by and by. It's almost as if the Lord is saying, hey, people are going to think they're the Messiah. Wars are going to happen. Don't panic yet. All right. We keep on going. Verse 10. Nation shall rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. Boy, that's happened for the last 2,000 years. Great earthquakes shall be in diverse places, famines and pestilence and fearful sights and great signs shall there be from heaven. Now, that's interesting because there's all kinds of discussion about what we're seeing as far as the weather and climate and all that stuff. But it says great signs shall there be from heaven. When you start talking about signs in the Bible, we're talking absolute supernatural events. Let me go through some of the signs in the Bible. After Noah's flood, when a rainbow was put in the sky, that was called a sign. Remember when the fleece was put out, dew was on the fleece, but it was dry around the outside? That was a sign. Isaiah said when a virgin gives birth, that is a sign. Jesus said, one sign I'll give you, that is Jonah's in the belly of the whale 3 days and three nights, so he would be in the heart of the earth 3 days and three nights. Somebody raising from the dead, that's a sign. It says there shall be great signs from heaven. That means there will be things above us that cannot be explained among us. Great signs. And so, yes, we've seen the wars. Yes, we've seen the commotions. I would state that I don't know if you and I personally have started to see this part of it. I mean, we're not seeing. I mean, you go back and you read in Revelation. I know some of you ladies are taking my wife's study on Tuesday morning. You start reading the things that happen when the trumpets sound and the vials go off. There are great signs in heaven. There is a star named Wormwood who comes out of the sky, hits the water, and a third of all the life dies. I would call that a great sign. Okay? When there are events of that magnitude, that is a great sign. We have, you and I have not seen that as of yet. But look at verse 12. What's the first word? But. See, this is what's significant for you and I. Before all of these, it's almost as if Jesus had said, these are the things I'm speaking about. When you see these things happen, it's the last generation. Verse 12, I think, is critical to you and I. But before all these, they shall lay their hands on you, persecute you, delivering you up to the synagogues, prisons, being brought before kings and rulers for my name's sake, and it shall turn to you for a testimony. Wow. It says one thing that we're guaranteed of, even before the big finale, there's going to be persecution. There's going to be an uprising against the believers. What did Jesus say? Marvel not, the world hates you, it hates or hated me first. And then he talks about how you'll be able to speak, et cetera, et cetera. Verse 20 then talks about the destruction of Jerusalem. Now, we could spend hours and hours and hours and hours and hours on this chapter. But based on the question that was asked, the last generation, as Jesus spoke of, I believe there's two qualifications. Number one, qualification is what we know as Israel that looks like a dead branch has to, quote, be rebudded. That has happened. You can't argue that one. The second thing is, these things have come to pass. I don't think we can say all of those things have come to pass as of yet. Now, when they will occur is up to the Lord. Will they occur? Absolutely. Are you going to be a part of the last generation? It's possible. But it's possible you may not be. We just don't know. So, but here's the thing I think is important for us. Verse 12. But you will be, they will lay their hands on you. The Bible makes it very clear that even if you're not in the last generation, you will be persecuted. You will be brought before rulers. You will be tried. And so I think this idea of, okay, everything is going to be wonderful until the last generation. No, no, no. That's not what it says. In fact, it says that things will not be necessarily great for believers leading up to that point. I don't know if that answered the question sufficiently. I don't know who asked it, but I'm sure there's going to be some follow-up on this one. So let's go for it. Anybody? Anybody? Anyone? No, I need to do my auctioneer voice. Going once, going twice, going once, going twice. I can do it. Are we going to sell it on that and we're done? Really? Okay, go for it. I knew we couldn't. Honestly, we just have a few minutes left. I didn't want to break out a new question with a few minutes. Yes, ma'am. Yes. Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Right. What she's alluding to back in Luke 21, beginning in verse 13, and it shall turn to you for a testimony, settle it therefore in your hearts, not to meditate before what you shall answer. I will give you a mouth and wisdom which all your adversaries shall not be able to gainsay nor resist. You shall be betrayed by parents, brethren, kinsfolks, friends, and some of you they shall cause to be put to death. You shall be hated of all men for my name's sake. Wow, that's exciting. But that's what it says. To your point, I think, I don't know what you're alluding to. It's almost as if the Lord says, don't worry about it. when they begin to persecute you, don't panic. I'll give you the words you need in the time that you need it. You'll know exactly what to say when you need to say it. I don't know if that's what you're getting at. Yep, that's in verse 18. But there shall not be a hair of your head perish. The idea that you get there is that in the midst of persecution, that the Lord takes care of those who stand on His behalf. We could tell stories infinitum. I know there's going to be testimony of a missionary here later tonight. When you speak to those who serve on the mission field all over the world, the stories are fascinating about how in the midst of very non-Christian environments, the Lord protects them, takes care of them, guides them, gives them wisdom, gives them words they never knew to say. I don't want to spoil, you know, Brother David Smith, our missions pastor, I don't want to spoil his thunder because y'all will hear him teach and preach over time. But he has got some unbelievable stories about how here he was in a country that was, not just predominantly, but almost exclusively Muslim. And how authorities came into his house, saw the, quote, Christian literature, and he said it's almost as if they were blinded. They saw it, but didn't see it and didn't do a thing. And so when it says, I'll give you the words to say, sometimes the words to say is nothing. They just stood there and prayed. And he'll give you the color commentary. But those stories go and go and go and go. I can tell you stories I know of missionaries, and I know I love missionary stories. Stories of a mission. I'll close with this one because I think this, when we think of persecution, and for those of us, and I know we teased about our ages earlier and going to heaven, but what we have seen, the current Islamic persecution, that is, in our generations, that is a modern phenomenon. It really is. For most of us, the persecution of Christianity came from communist Russia. And you think of Cuba and some of those entities that for decades and decades and decades, Christianity was illegal, Bibles couldn't be in, Marxism ruled. I mean, that's generally what most of you grew up thinking is persecution. Story of some missionary friends of mine that spoke of the fact that they desired to take a Bible into Russia. Now, this is back before the curtain came. Well, the curtain was still up. The Berlin Wall was still up. We're talking back in the 80s or the 70s. Speaks about this missionary who just said, it was a woman, felt led of God to go and take a Bible into Russia. She didn't know what to do with it. She didn't know what she was. In other words, here I am, to your point, this is a land of persecution. This is a land where she could be, if not jailed, killed for doing what she's doing. The Lord leads her to do it. She goes into downtown Moscow. All right. She feels led to go into the Russian Orthodox Church that's there on Red Square. Now, understand, they still have churches there. They're just run by the government at the time. She goes in to this church. She sits in a pew with this Bible in her lap, doesn't know what to do, doesn't have a clue what to do. And all of a sudden, someone comes up to her and taps her on the shoulder and says, is that a Bible? She said, yes. They said, can I have a page? And they tore a page of it out and took off. And then another person came, and another person came, and another person came. She never said a word. She just was in the right place where God told her to be with a copy of His Word. Now, the story gets even better. She goes through all that, goes back home and says, oh my, this is phenomenal. By the way, this really wasn't what we call a career missionary. This was a college professor who was doing this that went on a short-term mission. Goes back later with a whole bag of Bibles so that when they came and tapped her on the shoulder, she gave them a whole copy over her shoulder. To your point, when the persecution is heated and it is intense, God supernaturally guides, directs our mouths, our languages, and to your point, He just takes care of us. Folks, and I'm going to close on this. Here in the United States of America, the flames of persecution are beginning to be fired up. Let's go back to the story. Don't panic. Stay in tune with God, and He'll guide you what to say. He'll guide you what to do. He'll make sure you're in the right place at the right time doing the right thing. And He said, don't worry about it. I could tell stories. I could tell stories of believers and missionaries that have been put in prison. And can tell you that in prison, they felt as free as they've ever been anywhere else in the world. Why? Because God took care of them. Now, we think of that and go, oh, my, what would I do if they ever took me to prison? What would I do? What would I do? What would I do? It says, don't worry about what you do. If they do it, he'll take care of you when you go. I think the Apostle Peter showed us this worked really well because he went out and preached one day. They threw him into prison. What happened that night? Angel came in and let him out. It's all pretty good. It can happen. You know, so once again, to your point, yes, we see it happening. Yes, we're getting closer. Don't panic. Don't fret. He's going to take care of us and show us what to do.